future, where we derived the interacting form of the Boltzmann equation and then got a solution for it. Okay, so just to recap what we found, we derived the Boltzmann equation, and it has a form similar to what we had been arguing based on dimensional analysis. The change in number density, there's some Hubble term that's associated with the expansion of the universe, which dilutes the number density. And then there's an interaction term, which tends to drive chi to its equilibrium number density. And it does so at a rate that is gamma is n sigma b. We put the equation in a simpler form, and we're able to find an approximate analytic solution to it. And we found that, just as in our intuitive argument, that at a certain point, chi stops finding each other to annihilate, and so there's some what we call relic abundance of chi, which means that even at very late times, at time infinity, there's an abundance of chi that's given by this expression. Okay? And we derived it in terms of this freeze-out scale. These scales are basically the temperature, the mass over the temperature. And this was logarithmically dependent on various quantities. So what's nice about this scale is that regardless of what we put in here, when we put sort of reasonable values, we typically end up with numbers that are like 20 to 30. They differ by a factor of 2. So what this means is that the prediction of what chi is doesn't really depend much on the X freeze out. So what we're going to do today is finish this off by plugging in these constants and seeing what this abundance of chi means in terms of the physical parameters of the theory, so the scattering rates. And what we eventually want to do is connect this to dark matter. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to say, okay, if I want this particle chi to be dark matter based on how much dark matter I know to be there, say from the CMB or from other measurements, what properties of the particle physics theory encoded in sigma v have to be there. Okay. All right, so the first topic that we're going to discuss, it's called the Wimp miracle, which is a sort of dramatic name for it, but it's basically the realization that if we want the dark matter abundance to come out right, then the characteristic scale that we find is the scale of electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay. And this is pretty amazing because all we've been talking about is cosmology and, you know, thermal freeze-out and things that have nothing to do with particle physics. We've seen it before, and out pops some scale that's familiar to us. Okay. So let's see how that works. So what we want is, eventually what we want is we want to match the Planck measurement, which says that omega dark matter is about 0.27. And this was defined as rho dark matter over this critical energy density that we defined in lecture 2. And if chi is going to be dark matter, then this formula, we just want omega dark matter to be omega. All right, so in order to do that, we know that rho dark matter, because it's non-relativistic today, it's just going to be the mass of dark matter times the number density of dark matter. And we can, again, use entropy conservation to write n in terms of this yield. Okay? So we can say m dark matter, n dark matter over S today times S today. Okay. So this gives us M dark matter, Y dark matter, S today. So now the good news is that we've actually just computed what Y of this chi is, and so we can just check and see if the amount of chi that we get matches dark matter, or conversely, what parameters we have to have in our theory in order to have enough chi left today in order to be dark matter. Okay, so in order to evaluate this expression for y chi of infinity, we need to plug in our values of lambda, et cetera. So this went like, over lambda times x. Is that to the n plus 1? So lambda, as I wrote down, it's x, s of x, sigma v over Hubble x, evaluated at x equals 1. So let's figure out what these various quantities mean. So evaluating x equals 1 just means that I'm evaluating all of these things when the mass is equal to the temperature. Okay. So we can use the expressions that we had before. So the entropy looks something like 2 pi squared over 45 g star s t cubed. So this is just going to be 2 pi squared over 45 g star s and chi cubed at x equals 1. Okay. I can do the same thing with Hubble. So this is just 1.66 root g star t squared over m Planck. So once again, I'm just going to get m chi squared over m Planck. So now I can just plug in for lambda. So what I get is that lambda is some coefficients, which are some order one numbers, times m chi cubed from the entropy over m chi squared over m Planck from Hubble times sigma n. And this is going to go like, putting in all of the constants. This is just m Planck over m chi. Sorry, m Planck m chi sigma n. Okay, so we can now plug this into our expression for y chi. So what we find is that y chi, so the number density, goes like n plus 1. X frees out to the n plus 1 m chi m Planck sigma n. So this is the amount of this particle that's left over. And now we can just test to see if it has the same amount as dark matter. And we see that y chi is a function both of the scattering cross-section and of m chi itself. So now we can use this line of argument and say, well, I want rho chi to be rho dark matter. I can use this formula. So rho chi is m chi y chi infinity s naught. And just for numerical purposes, I'll tell you that S naught is about 2,000 per centimeters cubed. It's approximately the amount of CMB photons per centimeter cubed. So something interesting happens when I plug this in. So I just multiply y chi by these two numbers. I find that rho chi, the energy density, goes like this x freeze-out dependence times S naught over sigma n m Planck. So actually, when I compute the energy density of chi, the m chi in the numerator cancels the m chi in the denominator, and I find that the amount contribution of the energy density of chi is independent of its mass. Right? This is really weird because it's a non-relativistic particle, and so you expect that its mass is going to show up somewhere because that's the dominant contribution to the energy, but it exactly cancels this factor in the number density. In fact, the energy density depends on three things, all of which are known. So we know what S naught is just from the temperature of the CMB. We know what M Planck is. And we know that X freeze out is, first of all, we can write it in terms of the parameters of theory, but it's always a factor of about 20. So the big, big story is that rho chi is proportional to 1 over sigma v. And this is the main dependence on the particle physics. What this means is that when I have a larger scattering cross-section, the abundance goes down. And this isn't too surprising because we know that what's happening during freeze-out is that it's harder for chi to find each other, and eventually the annihilation rate drops below the energy density of the universe. And so if I make it interact stronger, it takes longer for that to happen. But it's a very simple dependence. And because of the symbol dependence, we can draw very strong conclusions if we want chi to be dark matter about what has to be true for this. Okay? So this equation basically is the direct link between particle physics and cosmology. And this gives particle physicists something to aim for. If you're constructing a theory of dark matter, that the dark matter abundance is explained in this way, you now know you have a way of getting the dark matter abundance. Okay. So let's actually figure out numerically what this sigma v has to be. So we know that omega dark matter. Okay. We know that dark matter is composed of this chi particle. But I've been a little bit fast and loose, because we have both a chi and a chi bar. Okay? And we know that the number density of chi is equal to the number density of chi bar. And so both of them are going to contribute to dark matter. So really, the dark matter abundance is not just rho chi, but is rho chi plus rho chi bar over rho critical. So I get some factor of 2 here. Okay. So if I make various assumptions, like S wave annihilation, which means that this n parameter is 0. Remember that we did this expansion in sigma v, that it was A plus B x to the minus 2, dot, 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 dot. All this is saying is that we're going to neglect all of this and just consider this leading order term. Okay, let's take G star of about 100. This is about what it is in the standard model at high temperatures. X frees out of about 30. Again, and you can change all of these numbers, and it changes the number I'm about to give you by an order one factor. When I plug all of these in here, what I find is that omega dark matter I made a mistake in my notes. About 10 to the minus 9 GeV to the minus 2 over sigma V. And so trying to match the Planck data gives me a very concrete prediction. Namely, sigma V is approximately equal to 4.4 times 10 to the minus 9 GeV to the minus 2, or as it's often written, because it's a nice even number, 6 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. So because it's natural units, I can just multiply by factors of h bar and c, and I can convert between these things. Yes?
So you said that the doesn't really depend on the mass of the matter particle. But x frees out does depend on logarithmic values.
It does, that's right, it does. So that'll maybe change it from 30 to 20.
30 to 25
or so, yeah. So often there's an m chi dependence in sigma v. So there can be implicit dependence on m chi, but the point is that if, let's say, I somehow manage to arrange this so that my sigma v doesn't depend on m chi or something like this, then it's completely independent. So the naive expectation is that I need to get two numbers right. I need to get the number density right and the mass right. And all this relationship is telling us is that the energy density only depends on the cross-section, not on the mass. Okay. So yeah, if the cross-section depends on mass, then there's a mass dependence. And that's often the case. But let's put it this way. It's very convenient from a, say, phenomenological perspective, because it gives us a number that we have to reach for. It's not just, oh, I assume dark matter mass is this, and so this is my rate. So notice that, so this is for what we call Dirac dark matter, where chi is not equal to chi bar, because we had this factor of 2 here. If dark matter is what we call Majorana, which means that dark matter is its own antiparticle, we don't get this factor of 2, and so sigma v is 3 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. So this is the number that you'll often see quoted, because the basic assumption that people make is Majorana. But it's literally just this factor of 2 here that's changing. Okay. So let's see what this implies for actual parameters in a particle physics model. So what we can do is we can write down some sort of proposed interaction between chi and f, estimate the rate, and just see what this implies for the parameters. So before, we had considered this simple model where we have chi bar annihilating through the z, going to ff bar.
Okay.
So I'm going to, before we had been keeping around separate gz chi and gz f, I'm just going to make them equal to the same for the time being, because they're basically comparable in magnitude. And so we showed a while ago that for t much, much less than m chi, but much bigger than, say, mf or mz, that this estimate for the cross-section was like 1 over 8 pi gz to the fourth m chi squared. Okay. And that was just because the matrix element has a gz squared, so you square that. Then you get this 1 over m chi squared because you get a 1 over energy to the fourth from the propagator and energy squared in the numerator, and this is the dominant energy contribution. And then there was this phase space factor. Okay, so because this is a standard model particle, we know what gz is. It's about 0.6. You can evaluate in terms of it's like e over sine theta cos theta, where theta is the Weinberg angle, but I'll just say that it's about 0.6. So when we plug this in, what we find is that sigma v can be equal to our magical value of the cross section for very specific choices of the parameters. Okay. So what does this tell us? It tells us that if we use the standard model value for the Z coupling, then if M chi is 700 GeV, I get the correct dark matter abundance. Okay. So this is what's known as the WIMP miracle. Here, WIMP stands for weakly interacting massive particle. What we see is that when a particle has a coupling that's equal to the electroweak coupling and has a mass that is around the weak scale, so a few hundred GeV or up to a TeV, then you automatically satisfy the conditions for getting the right dark matter candidate. And this is a complete coincidence, because there's absolutely nothing about the dark matter abundance today that should be connected to the weak scale, but it is. Now, it's worth pointing out that it's not really a miracle in the sense that it's not a very definitive prediction, because as you see, if I replace this z with some other particle, then what I really have is a line in the parameter space, which is that as I make the coupling bigger, I can get away with making the mass bigger as well. Okay. So this really defines sort of a line that we can deal with, but at least it's something to aim for. And we can actually do something, drive something that's called a unitarity bound. And what we mean by unitarity bound is that notice that as I make my dark matter mass bigger, my annihilation rate wants to go down. So I can compensate this for by an increase in the coupling. So lower m chi means higher coupling. But I can only increase the coupling so much, because we calculated this in perturbation theory, and there's some assumption that the higher order diagrams don't contribute. And in particular, if my coupling gets too big, then my theory becomes non-perturbative. I have absolutely no control over what's going on. Okay? I should say that this is a perturbative unitarity bound. So I can only, sorry, this is raising the dark matter mass. Lowers the cross section because it's in the denominator. So I can only raise my dark matter mass so much before I just can't make my coupling bigger anymore. So if I make a very, very conservative assumption say g is less than about 4 pi. The reason why you do that is that a loop factor is like 1 over 16 pi squared. So this is like the absolute worst. I mean, you're probably already non-perturbative at this point. But if you plug in g less than about 4 pi, what you find is that m chi has to be less than, say, order of 100 TeV. So what this does is it puts an upper limit on if I want my dark matter to have an abundance through this thermal freeze-out mechanism, it can't actually be too heavy. Because if it were too heavy, then the annihilation rate I would need to explain the right abundance would violate perturbative unitarity. Yeah.
So, I mean, so you're assuming that somehow its interaction with everything else is perturbative. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be like that.
It doesn't. So people make arguments that if the coupling goes non-perturbative, then the correct degrees of freedom switch. Okay, but then in terms of those new fundamental perturbative degrees of freedom, this constraint basically still applies. So now that's not a proved theorem, but I think in concrete realizations where people have tried to build a non-perturbative model, that this is the boundary that barrier you still run into. And of course, by unitarity, what I basically mean is that when I compute probabilities of scattering, some of the partial wave amplitudes go above 1. So the probabilities become nonsensical. Okay. So that saying is that there's just it's not possible to consistently couple something that's strong enough that explains the dark matter abundance. Yeah.
So this unitarity doesn't have anything to do with assumptions about renormalizability of the theory.
No. This is just this is a unitarity bound on the coupling evaluated at m chi. Okay. So, for instance, if my coupling is 3, we still consider that within the unitarity bound, but of course you hit a Landau pole right above the scale. Okay. So this is really just at the scale of annihilation. And I should comment that this doesn't meean the dark matter can't be heavier than 100 TeV. So for instance, if dark matter is made up of dark atoms or something that have lots of fundamental particles that annihilate through thermal freeze-out, the sort of particle dark matter that we see now could be very heavy, but the constituents that we're freezing out have to be lighter than about 100 TeV. Okay. So this is basically WIMP dark matter. And people think a lot about WIMP dark matter. And the reason why historically people think a lot about WIMP dark matter is that it's connected to a scale that we already know is in the standard model. It's the weak scale. And in particular, there's this problem associated with the Higgs that the Higgs picks up contributions to its mass from loops of various particles and so if you couple the Higgs to some very heavy particle then these quantum corrections tend to drive the Higgs to a very high scale but we observe the Higgs to be very light relative to say the Planck scale and so the hope is that there's some new stuff that gives say an opposite contribution so that these cancel. And these new particles have to have masses around the weak scale. So this is for a long time has been the motivation for why WIMP dark matter is such a good idea. So is that solutions to other problems of the standard model often predict new particles that are in your theory, and then they just freeze out, and one of them is your dark matter candidate. This idea is still appealing, but it's maybe a bit less appealing now that the LHC has explored a lot of the weak scale and hasn't really seen anything yet. So there's still ways that these new particles could be hiding, but certainly this simple framework is not as favored. There are other reasons why WIMPs are nice. So WIMPs have large sigma v at TeV scale energies. Okay, I mean, the coupling in the theory is order 1. It couples just as strongly as a lot of standard model particles. It's just that at very low energies, it only couples through very heavy mediators, and so it's difficult to see. And so because dark matter has a large scattering cross-section at high energy, but a low scattering cross-section at low energy, it can both satisfy the Planck constraints, or the CMB constraints on dark matter self-interaction, and the dark matter interaction with the standard model. And yet, it still interacts with standard model particles so that I can see it. So I can actually look for WIMPs in experiments. It's not just hopelessly decoupled. And of course, the reason why a lot of people like it as well is that it's very predictive. That if I write down a theory, I know how to calculate everything, and I can just get out the dark matter abundance. Okay, so do any people have any questions about the WIMP miracle or how I'm defining WIMP dark matter?
Does the Higgs solution assume it's the Higgs mechanism giving the dark matter possible to mass? I mean, you could apply a mass to it.
Yeah, so we're assuming that the mass does not come from the Higgs. So you can make assumptions that the dark matter mass comes through the Higgs, and then that imposes even more constraints on the parameters in the theory. Okay. But this is just saying I'm adding some new particle that couples to the Z or something else that interacts with the standard model. So in particular, if it's an extra particle that you're adding, you can write things that are like X bar X times the gauge singlet, and then couple this to the standard model, and then you can just explicitly write down a mass term. Okay, so I don't need to give the mass to the Higgs mechanism.
So. I was just curious when these predictions were initially made, like when people wrote this down.
This I think was really developed in the 80s, okay, and it was largely developed in the context of supersymmetric theories. I'll talk about that in a little bit. At that point, we didn't have a very precise measurement of the matter content. So they knew that baryons couldn't account for all of the energy in the universe. But the assumption was that there was something like 20% baryons and 80% dark matter or something like this. Okay. Then the discovery of the cosmological constant completely changed everything. And it was discovered that actually most of the gap between matter and the critical density was dark energy. And then dark matter filled the rest of that, and then baryons were a very small fraction of that. So it was, in the 80s, a lot of this was being worked out. As we'll talk about, the simplest WIMP models were excluded. Like, for instance, couplings through the Z, if it's elastic scattering through the Z, that how it couples to the standard model is completely ruled out. And they started doing experiments for this in like the 80s. So in some ways, so it's nice that we didn't have a precise prediction of the dark matter and at that time, and that it's only gotten better. However, the dark matter abundance has changed by order one quantities over the past few decades, and it's easy to get order one changes in the abundance by just changing these couplings. Any other questions? But the particle that couples to the Higgs doesn't have to be the dark matter particle. So for instance, I'll give you a model, but for instance, in supersymmetry, you get superpartners of everything. So you can have the superpartner of the top cancel the Higgs divergence, and you can have the superpartner of the photon be dark matter, something like that. Yeah. So this is more motivation for, we expect new things at the weak scale, and it's very non-trivial to get this cancellation. Okay, so in order for this cancellation to work, you usually have to add in a whole bunch of stuff, whether you're doing it by supersymmetry or strong dynamics or whatever. And usually somewhere in all of that stuff you're adding, there's a stable particle, and that can be your dark matter. But that's a good question. Yeah. Okay. So we've seen how the basic mechanism works, but we want to understand what properties the models have to have in order to be viable. Okay. So of course, the first property it has to have is that omega chi equals omega dark matter, which is basically the same up to order one factors that sigma v is this number. And again, this isn't really correct anymore because the Planck abundance has shifted by some 10% since this was predicted. But 3 and 6 are such nice round numbers that everyone just says 3 times 10 to the minus 26. So the second most important condition is that once we produce the dark matter, it doesn't go away. So in particular, we want these chi processes, chi decay process to be forbidden. The reason is that if I want, say, you know, Kai to live, have a lifetime longer than the age of the universe, so say 14 billion years or so, this corresponds to Kai decay width that's less than about 10 to the minus 40 GeV. Very small number. And if I, for instance, do a usual two-body decay where I have Chi decay into, you know, something else and something else, again, by dimensional analysis, we see, okay, well, I'm going to have two powers of this coupling because there's one power in the matrix element and I square it, so there's going to be some G decay squared. I'm going to put a 1 over 8 pi for our phase space factor. And then there has to be a mass. And the only mass in this problem is m chi. So if I plug in, say, a TeV scale mass here, what I find is that g decay has to be less than about 10 to the minus 21. So it doesn't take much looking between these two formulas to see that if I want to get a coupling through thermal freeze-out, the coupling for annihilation of chi has to be hugely bigger than the coupling for decay of phi. And if I have a theory that generically allows both through the same kind of dynamics, there's no way you can simultaneously satisfy this condition. So we need to work to specifically find theories that have large annihilation rates and small decay rates. So the way that we're going to do this is by looking for theories where by fiat we say chi cannot decay. And the way that you can do that is through adding a symmetry that forbids chi decay. So what we want to allow are things that look like this. So either where chi annihilates with itself or with a chi bar to FF bar. So this is good. This is bad. So the way that we can do this is by saying that I'm going to impose upon my theory the requirement that any interaction between chi and the standard model involves two chi's. So if I require that any interaction involves two chi's, then you see that I can never end up with this kind of process, because this process takes something that has one chi and turns it into no chi's. Whereas this process is allowed, because it takes two chi's and it turns them into nothing, right, which is allowed. More mathematically, this is an example of what we call a Z2 symmetry, or it's also known as a parity symmetry. Have people seen Z2 symmetries before? Maybe. That's right. So what a Z2 symmetry is that everything has a charge of either plus 1 or minus 1. And then at any given interaction, you multiply the charges. Okay? So what we're going to say is that under the symmetry, chi and chi bar have charge minus 1. The standard model has charge plus 1. And so we see that this initial state has charge minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. So if this symmetry is preserved, I cannot take this negative charge into a positive charge. However, here I'm taking two negative charge states, which together have a net positive charge, and turn them into a positively charged state. So this kind of symmetry allows this structure where this interaction can happen, and this interaction cannot happen. Now, it could be that the symmetry is actually bigger. You can have continuous symmetries and whatnot. But this is the simplest symmetry. Right? And it, so usually if we're looking at models, we don't want to add spurious symmetry, you know. So this is often considered because it's the simplest thing that you need in order for your dark matter model to work. But really, any situation where the dark matter charge is different from any combination of standard model charges is okay. If I have it so that the dark matter charge can be equal to some combination of standard model charges, this particle will decay. Because you'll be able to draw a Feynman diagram with enough loops that will lead it to decay. And because the coupling is so constrained for the decay, that's probably ruled out. Or at least the onus is definitely on you to show that it's not ruled out. This also suggests that the universe can be divided into two sectors, which are even under the Z2, which have positive charge, and odd under the Z2. So we know that in the Z2 even sector, there's all of the standard model particles. And in principle, we know that there has to be at least dark matter, but there could, in principle, also be other particles here. And what we find is that the lightest Z2 odd particle is stable, and it is the dark matter. Okay. And how can we see that? Well, if we produce, consider some particle that has charge -1, all of its interactions when it decays can go to a +1 state and a -1 state. And even if that particle decays, it can only decay to a +1 state and a -1 state. And so what you find is that at the very bottom, there's always some -1 state that doesn't have anything to decay to. Okay. So usually this is referred to as a dark sector and the visible sector in very loose terms, the way that I'm using it. The basic idea being that there are things that when they decay give you dark matter, and there are things that when they decay don't give you dark matter. And so dark matter is this lightest parity odd particle. Okay. So now that we have written down these two conditions, these are basically, from the theory side, the two main consistency conditions for dark matter. Okay? There are going to be other constraints from the fact that there, you know, we haven't actually observed dark matter's particle interaction properties. So you know, depending on its coupling to the standard model, you can exclude various classes of models. But if we temporarily set that aside, we can basically write down anything that has the right cross section and that has a Z2 symmetry. And it's almost too easy to write down dark matter models, which is perhaps the problem that we have today, which is that particularly in light of these arguments from the hierarchy problem maybe being a bit weaker, we can write down all kinds of things. So for instance, what we've written down where chi annihilates through a gauge boson. This is known as the vector portal because these chis are interacting through a vector. You can also have other portals. So for instance, if chi is a scalar, then you can write down in your Lagrangian sum phi squared Higgs squared term. This is known as the Higgs portal, and you'll study this on your problem set. And this one, not surprisingly, has gotten a lot of interest because we've now discovered the Higgs, and so you can kind of look for evidence for dark matter in Higgs properties. There is, you know, a fermion portal where you have chis going into fermions like this, etc. So I mean, there's a ton of these kinds of models. So I'm not going to focus too much on particular models, because what we're really more interested in are how are these different classes of models tested, how do they show up in different experiments. But just because of the fact that it's been so important historically, I do want to talk about one specific model of dark matter, which is in supersymmetry. So I know that not all of you have taken the BSM course, so I'll just give a sort of 2-minute version of what supersymmetry is. Supersymmetry is motivated by this realization that we want to cancel these contributions to the Higgs mass from things from fermions that run in the loop. And one thing that we know from the first quantum field theory course is that when I compute loops of particles, whether there's a boson or a fermion inside of the loop flips the sign of the loop. Okay. So if I want to have a cancellation there, then the easiest way to do it is to have a fermion running in the loop, and then to have a corresponding boson loop. So if this is a particle psi, we'll call this psi tilde. And if these contributions are the same, then they exactly cancel. So this basically subtracts this, and we want it to go to zero. So this is weird. It imposes a symmetry between bosons and fermions. Because at least in the standard model, there's no connection between bosons and fermions. So there's no reason why a fermion loop should cancel a boson loop. But if I force the theory to do that, if I say I'm just going to make this coupling the same as this coupling, then you can see this diagram goes like g squared, this diagram goes like g squared. They have opposite signs, they cancel. And this is essentially what supersymmetry is. There are various ways of formulating it, but all we really need to know is the fact that every fermion has to be accompanied by a boson, and vice versa. And the charges are related. So in particular, the gauge charges of psi and psi tilde are equal. Okay. So this means that if I have a top quark here, then I also need to have a bosonic top, which we call a stop. Okay. So more generally, for a quark, there is a bosonic squark, okay, and they're all colored. Similarly, we have an electron. There's a superparticle called a selectron. It has electric charge of -1, and so on and so on. So there's this mapping, for instance, quark. There's the squark. Lepton goes to slepton. Okay. Gauge boson. We now have to tie the gauge boson to a fermion. And usually it's through a spin 1/2 fermion. So these are called gauginos. The general rule is if it's a scalar superparticle, you stick an S in front of the name. If it's a fermion superparticle, you stick eno on the end of the title. So this gives weird names. So for instance, there's stop, which is fine, spottum, which is kind of weird, strange, which is very weird, et cetera. Okay. All right, so then the last particle in standard model, of course, is the Higgs, which is also a boson. It's a scalar, so it has a fermion superpartner, which is called a Higgsino. Okay, so that's fine. We've added all of these new particles to our theory. But it turns out that SUSY has some issues associated with it. Namely, that it mediates all kinds of processes that we really wish wouldn't happen. So in particular, it's possible, in principle, to write down a color invariant combination of three colored objects. Okay, so for instance, we know that a neutron, for instance, this is made up of an up quark, a down quark, and a down quark. But so you might say, okay, well, the neutron should therefore be charged under SU3. But we know that it's not. It's a neutral asymptotic bound state. And the reason why is that there's this color invariant object, the Levi-Civita tensor, which we can contract with the color indices on each of these, and this gives a color invariant object. Okay. Now, in the standard model, this kind of interaction doesn't occur, because if I try to just write down in my Lagrangian something that goes like UDD, you immediately see that there's a problem, because I want my Lagrangian to be Lorentz invariant, but this has spin 1/2, this has spin 1/2, and this has spin 1/2. So I can't construct a Lorentz invariant object. And so this kind of coupling is forbidden in the standard model. But we're now mucking around with the Lorentz structure of our theory. Okay? We now have scalars that are colored objects as well. So we can, for instance, write down something in our Lagrangian that looks like epsilon ijk ui dj scalar d. Okay. This is renormalizable. It's color invariant. It's consistent with all the gauge symmetries. So this coupling should be in our theory according to the usual arguments. Okay. And this, as we will quickly see, leads to a catastrophe, because what this mediates is processes that look like this. U d bar squark squark d plus u bar. So there are corresponding diagrams you can write down for coupling squarks, quarks, and leptons. Okay. So what is this? We're starting with a UUD final state. This is a proton. And what we're left with is a U D bar U bar D E plus final state. This is a pi plus. This is a pi minus and E plus. Right? Now the mass of the pion is observed to be about 130 MeV. The mass of the electron is about half an MeV. So what I see is that this mediates proton decays to pi plus, pi minus, E plus. Very quickly, actually. Like with typical rates, this happens in less than a second. So the problem with this, of course, is that everything that we see is made of protons. So protons cannot decay on a time scale of a second. In fact, the lifetime of protons has to be bigger than about 10 to the 34 seconds, I think. Okay, so we're about 34 orders of magnitude off in our estimate. Okay. So this should be reminiscent of the problem that we had here, which is that we have some large coupling which, in principle, could mediate a decay. But it doesn't. So just like for dark matter, what happens in supersymmetry is that we impose a new symmetry. Which is called R parity. And R parity is very simple. If I have a standard model particle, it has positive charge. If I have a superpartner, it has a negative charge. And this, of course, forbids this kind of interaction. And so this whole diagram goes away. So this should be reminiscent of what we just did for dark matter. And indeed, we can use the symmetry that had to be introduced to get the proton to be stable. And we can say, OK, I'm going to also use this as the thing that makes dark matter stable. So what I can do is I can put my sector as E2 even, Z2 odd sectors. So the Z2 even sector is going to be the standard model. So there's a top quark, there's the Higgs boson, there's an electron, there's all this kind of stuff. And here there's going to be my squark. And there's going to be, say, probably, usually at the bottom of the spectrum, the neutral particles. So the Higgs zeno, the beno, the neutral weno, these sorts of things. Okay. And so just like up there, we had a lightest parity odd particle. Here we're going to have a lightest supersymmetric particle. And if it's neutral, it's a dark matter candidate. So now there are four candidates that can be neutral, okay? Because there are they're the superpartners of the neutral things in the standard model, okay? Well, actually, there are more, but these are the ones that people generically focus on because they tend to be the lightest in supersymmetric theories. They are the gauge zenos and the Higgs zenos. Okay, so in SUSY, for reasons I won't explain, you typically have to have two Higgs bosons. So there are two Higgs zenos. There's a Higgs zeno up, Higgs zeno down. And then there's what you can think of as the Zeno. It's the gauge, or sorry, the fermion partner of the Z boson, and the Beano, which is the super partner of the photon, roughly speaking. And what's nice is that all of these have order one couplings to the standard model because they interact, their couplings are fixed by supersymmetry the same as the standard model ones. So this has electromagnetic strength coupling, this has SU2 weak strength coupling, and these have couplings that are both SU2 weak and Yukawa. Yes.
Why do you use W for Zeno?
Yeah, okay. So in the standard model, you have a hypercharge, which is B mu, and you have the SU2, which is usually W mu, and then the third component of the W and the B mix to give you Z and the. So depending on how these mix, you can think of them that way, but really this is the gauge-geno of hypercharge. This is the gauge-geno of the third component, hypercharge component of. That's correct. So just like in the standard model, how the W3 and the B mix, generically all four of these are going to mix. Because after you break electroweak symmetry, these are all neutral. They have the same quantum numbers. And so you can just write down effective couplings between them. And that is sort of the horror of SUSY dark matters. You have to worry about all of these admixtures and everything. So you know you can spend your whole life on this, which. Okay, no judgment if that's what you want to do. But the nice thing about it is that no matter which one you pick, they have electroweak strength couplings. So all of these are fit into the Wimp miracle paradigm. And this has driven motivated most of the searches for dark matter. Okay? Because in order for SUSY to do this cancellation, you need all of these superpartner masses to be around the weak scale. So you're kind of pinning it right to the weak scale. So this is the canonical example of WIMP dark matter. But from the cosmological side, there's no difference from just our very simple Chi-Chi bar model and this huge model. And in particular, the MSSM has something like 105 parameters in it. This is the minimally supersymmetric standard model. A lot of these are constrained by various things, but it's still a huge parameter space. And so you can try to exhaustively study the parameters, and people do this. But another approach is just to think of various kind of ways that the dark matter can interact and just study those independently. And there's probably some way you could embed it in supersymmetry because you have so much freedom. OK. So are there any questions about either the symmetry argument or the MSSM? OK, so just before we finish, I'm going to briefly discuss some variants. On freeze-out, which incidentally were also motivated largely by the supersymmetric dark matter. But the idea generally is that there are lots of new particles, or I should say potentially, lots of new particles in the spectrum. So if I just add a chi, OK, maybe I just have one new particle. But if I have, say, SUSY dark matter, I have some 20 or more particles. And our freeze-out calculation made the assumption that chi was the only particle that was relevant. And so what we'll see is that you can change the predictions. A freeze-out away from this particular parameterization where you know we expect order one couplings. And I mean, I hate to say that this is the reason why these have become more interesting in recent years, but part of this is motivated by the fact that we haven't seen dark matter in any of the more obvious ways of looking for it. And so then people say, well, there's still ways of getting the thermal abundance without having exactly the couplings predicted. Okay. So the one that I'm going to talk about today is resonant annihilation. And this is just the observation that when we wrote down our formula, so let's say this is dark matter annihilating through some particle A to FF bar. before we had said that if M chi is much bigger than MA, the cross section, you know, there's a propagator here. So let's define the momentum in this direction as K. We have a propagator that looks like this. So this just goes like 1 over M chi squared. If we flip the limit where M chi is much smaller than MA, this looks like 1 over MA squared. But notice what happens if this K squared becomes the same as MA squared. What we find is we have a pole in the propagator. And because sigma goes like M squared, we got a pole in sigma as well. So schematically, what this looks like is if I just draw sigma, or let me do M squared as a function of K, then what you see is that at small k, this MA squared dominates. So it's sort of flat. And then as you hit this pole, you get a big spike, and then it drops off again. So this is when k squared is about MA squared. And what this means is that our naive prediction can maybe give a cross-section that's too small. So if my couplings are in fact smaller than 0.6, then I can have this huge spike compensate for that and still give me the same sigma v. Now, naively, this looks bad because this predicts an infinite cross-section, right on the pole. But it turns out that there's actually an imaginary part of the propagator. So the real propagator, for lack of a better word, is I k squared minus a m squared plus I m a gamma a. Okay. And if you don't know where this comes from, don't worry about it too much. But if you remember that how we computed this form of the propagator was we considered various corrections to the propagator. And when we summed the infinite number of them, you got a 1 over. So if there's an imaginary part of this, this gets thrown up here. And the optical theorem tells us that the imaginary part of this is just the width. So what this means is that our cross-section that naively went like 1 over 8 pi g to the 4th over m chi squared, in this limit instead goes like 1 over 8 pi g to the 4th over MA gamma A. And we can do some estimate where gamma A just comes from this part of the diagram, not both of them. So, oh, you can't see over here. So. Gamma A goes like g squared over 8 pi ma. So we see that sigma is enhanced by m chi squared over ma squared g squared. So if g is a small number, this gives me some huge enhancement of my cross-section. So what this means is that if g is too small to give the naive satisfy this condition, then this center of mass energy thrown into the flow into this propagator is about equal, and you get this. Now, the only caveat I want to add to this is that this condition is true at zero momentum. Okay, if all the center of mass energy is coming from the mass, g during the time of thermal freeze-out, there's actually some contribution from the kinetic energy of these particles. So usually the resonance condition isn't quite this. It's like shifted a little bit to account for the fact that in the early universe there's no energy. So in some ways that makes us even less motivated, because it's like the position of this particle mass has to be just right so that in the early universe you're annihilated through it. But if you have a particle like theory like supersymmetry where you have some 20 new particles, maybe you're lucky and they just happen to fall that way, and maybe the dark matter abundance we see is because of that. Okay. That's all I have for today. I guess I'll see you next week. And yeah, feel free to ask me if you have any questions.
Well, what is A? Like, you probably mentioned this, I guess.
It's some particle. The reason why we do this is that often in supersymmetry, this A is a pseudoscalar associated with the other Higgs boson. But it could be a new, I could have written Z, but that's very constrained because we know a lot about the Z. But this is going to be, because this is just a kinematic effect, this does not depend on the Lorentz structure of the theory.